Take a network break, help yourself to a virtual donut, and join us as we traipse through this week's tech news. We've got a new product from Arista, AI silicon competition heating up, Cisco executive shuffling, and more. We're sponsored today by Itential. You can improve your network automation from one-off scripts that only you can use to safe, robust automations you can share with your entire IT organization with Itential. Itential helps you implement NetDevOps so you can deliver self-service networking from ticket creation to ticket closure. Find out more at itential.com/packetpushers. And after the news, we have a sponsored Tech Bytes session with Cisco ThousandEyes. We're going to drill into new capabilities, including enhancements to endpoint monitoring to help IT more quickly identify performance issues by application and integrations with Cisco ThousandEyes and Cisco Secure Access so you can get correlated views for network and security teams to spot problem areas and identify fixes. All right, Craig, let's dive into the news. Arista has announced a new network observability capability that takes data center network telemetry from its EOS switches and marries it with application data from third-party devices, including firewalls and load balancers, as well as VM operation tools such as vCenter and OpenShift. The new service is called CV Uno. It is only available as part of Arista's SaaS-based CloudVision offering.
Yeah, well, you're the one who took the briefing here. I don't really, you know, you've got the details, so maybe you should tell us some more about the actual product. But this doesn't feel like this is going to threaten a network of visibility. I don't see this as observability. It's too limited. It's really just networking-centric. It sort of taps into the wider infrastructure from a networking point of view. But if you're going to do observability today, I think you have to go the whole stack, application observability and all the way down. This feels like network engineers are asking for network visibility and they've responded with the minimum effort.
Yeah, so the general use cases are to enhance troubleshooting by giving network engineers more information about application and infrastructure performance along with network performance. You can also pair it with Arista's change management workflow offering. It's called AVD. So using AVD, it's like a pipeline where you can do pre and post checks on potential changes. When you incorporate it with the CV Uno, you could say, hey, we're going to put out this configuration change, and CV Uno could say, you know, if you run that ACL that blocks that port, it's also going to block an application. Do you want to do that? And no, maybe you don't. So it does provide more application-related context to network events. So for example, they say if there are packet drops on the network, CV Uno can tell you which application was dropping the packets and where the drop happened, i.e. between a web server and a database server. So it's primarily about mean time to innocence for the network, if you can say to the application side of the house, we've looked at it, we can see that this is actually a host issue, maybe check the CPU, the memory on the host or whatever, and making sure that changes you make to the network don't have negative impacts on business critical applications.
Yeah, so it just sort of like, okay, so you put something in the cloud, you can charge a subscription to it.
Yes.
Sort of minimum effort, right? And this is late. Like we were talking about network observability like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was the first wave. And I sort of have Arista these days pegged as a market follower, right? They wait until the market for a particular product is absolutely mature, probably until the customers are saying, we're going to leave if you don't provide us with something. Mm-hmm. And then they look around and say, yeah, it'd be pretty easy to do that. We can just copy somebody else. And I know they're not copying, but you know, the market's well established. What customers are expecting is clear, stable, and they sort of put a minimum effort into building something and they'll start investing in it over time.
Yeah, I think that's the case because the way they're collecting data from third-party devices is SNMP and flow logs. They haven't set up APIs yet, which seems to me like, really? Okay, but that's fine. You can still get, you know, application information from flow records and from SNMP, so okay. And as we mentioned, you do have to get their CloudVision as a service to get this because all that data is being sent up into the cloud for Arista to analyze. And yeah, I very much feel like this is an Arista product in that there's not a lot of flash. It's not a big wow, but it does seem to me very sensible and useful and does also seem like something that could have come out 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say 10 years ago. I mean, they really should have had a visibility solution out 10 years ago and upgraded it to observability 5 years ago, you know, but that ability to take flow records and SNMP and streaming telemetry off your boxes and, you know, pass it through a gateway so it can be uploaded to the cloud in a meaningful way.
Yes.
And then do analysis. That's a well-established, well-understood, there are billion-dollar companies like Kentik and Nokia and many others, you know, even Cisco went out and spent $5 billion on a company to help do that. And another one, ThousandEyes, like spent $1 billion on ThousandEyes. It does even more for network observability than this. And it's, you know, so it's hard for me to get excited about this. I think this is really a very day-to-day pedestrian product that does exactly what you expect. It maps out the network, it collects the telemetry, it helps you identify operational issues. We've said a lot of the time here that operations is really the future. What we need in networking is to improve the operational speed, changes, faults, flaws, brownouts, you know, whatever we need to know. The days of having a network and sending a ping and going, it's okay, you can't. You have to say how much CPU's on this box. Where's my asset? Where's my inventory? What's my software versions? Is this link fully burnt? Is this burning? Is there a brownout on this link? Are those optics burning too much power? Are they optically too hot? You know, is the lambda too high, or is it falling away? Is that a sign of a transmission or a receiving laser failing under certain, you know, those are the things that they are now standard features. And Arista's announcing it now. It feels late. Yeah.
I feel like Arista is, you know, we know the bulk of their revenue comes from the hyperscalers, the cloud giants that they sell their switches to. And so the enterprise sometimes feels like it's, I don't want to say it gets short shrift, but their attention is often split. This feels like they decided our enterprise customers in the data center maybe have been asking us for more capabilities here. And so this is a way to say, yes, we love you too, and we're going to get some stuff out to you.
Yeah. And I imagine this is going to be modestly priced. It doesn't have all the features and the wow of some of the other parties. So if you could slap this on, you know, if you're an Arista customer, you've got a bunch of third-party stuff too. Like, you know, it also lets you pave over your other stuff, right? So if you want to hide the Cisco stuff in your network and put it underneath a tool like this, then this allows you to see Arista all the time. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So one of the things about observability tools is you can say, all right, I'll take your Cisco and your Juniper and your HPE, you know, network equipment, and I'll pull the telemetry from that. And all of a sudden, Arista's sitting over the top of all those hardware assets saying, they're not very important.
Right. You're looking at the Arista console while you're getting data from, you know, an F5, a Palo Alto, et cetera. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a psychological advantage when you have it. That's one of the big things that Juniper's got around Apstra is that it's got that psychological advantage, right?
Right. Yeah. This product is in beta now, going to be fully orderable in Q2 2024. Again, you have to be a CloudVision SaaS customer. If you've got CloudVision on-prem, this is not ready for you yet.
Not orderable until Q2. So not for another 6 months yet, probably.
Well, we're coming at the end of Q1. So it depends on where they mean in Q2. It could be
June. Is that
June,
marketing but... Q2 or real Q2?
Right. So recently we talked about NVIDIA's financial results that were absolutely bonkers good. Now we're seeing competition heat up in the chip industry to go after NVIDIA's hold on AI silicon. Case in point are two startups, Grok and Talos. Grok makes an AI processor and associated software for what it calls an LPU, or a language processing unit. It claims to be able to run large language models 10 times faster than competitors. And Grok was founded by the person who invented Google's Tensor processing unit. And recently Grok acquired a company to develop a cloud-based platform for developers to create generative AI applications.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to call out here, Drew, is this idea that NVIDIA is not the only AI company out there.
Yes.
And they have made so much money that, you know, it's like flies around a can of poop, right? All the flies are swarming around that cash and going like, hang on, they're making so much money. And so investment is pouring into this industry.
Yes.
And just to make the case or demonstrate that we're not just making it up, I picked out two. There's more. There's another one called Inflection AI, which is claiming that it can generate models with 40% of the sort of capacity and, you know, whatever. But in this case, it's Grok. They're talking about their own hardware silicon, LPU, which is language. So what we're seeing is AI silicon be developed for specific use cases. So instead of using NVIDIA's general purpose, non-specific GPU infrastructure that can do everything, it's much more efficient if you can design a piece of AI silicon that does a particular type of inference. And you can do it like at significantly performance. So the numbers that we're sort of seeing is half the power, twice the speed, less data because you can track more points on the model and so forth. And so these companies have actually got a real competitive edge. And more importantly, they've also got a path to market, right? They don't need to convince customers to go and buy that silicon and then put it somewhere and then write software that goes on top of it. What these companies can do is what OpenAI did, which is to say, we'll just generate the models and then put them online and you can access them via an AI. So as long as you can generate the silicon cheaply enough, run the models and then put it online, you've got a revenue source. All of a sudden you're generating revenue against it, right? So of course, once you've got a business built up, the silicon's being built, you've got a pipeline of product development going on, then you can start to look around and say, well, we need to sell this silicon to somebody. So maybe AWS, maybe Google, maybe we sell it to enterprises directly or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But my point is that NVIDIA is not the only AI story, far from it. And there are dozens, and I've picked out three here, and you have a look at them in the show notes, that are actually out there building AI inference motors with silicon, right? They're actually designing chips, getting them made, and then putting them into deployment in hosted, you know, or hosted offsite as the SaaS. They're not cloud hosted, they're SaaS really, because they have to have the hardware. And I think that's really, really interesting. And if you're thinking about your AI strategy, you have to stand back and say, maybe it's not always NVIDIA.
Yeah, there's a second startup called Talus. They just came out of stealth with $50 million to develop a foundry to produce faster, more efficient silicon for LLMs. Reading the press releases from both companies, they are touting how their systems are more power efficient. I don't know if that's just PR positioning, but there is a growing pushback against generative AI because of how power hungry the processes are that operate these generative AI applications. So yeah, you could see the Microsofts, the AWSs, and other, you know, hyperscalers of the world being like, yeah, you got a chip that'll do this at a tenth of the power. I need that because I'm spending a lot of money on electricity and cooling.
Yeah. I mean, NVIDIA's done a great job of selling GPUs as AI processors. Mm-hmm. But that's not, I don't believe now that that is going to be the long-term solution. You don't want general purpose GPUs doing your AI. It's much more likely that you're going to buy custom silicon for the AI tasks that you want. So we talked 2 or 3 weeks ago about this idea that there's LLMs, large language models, but people are now also generating large action models or generating a whole different version where the models are focused on a specific task. And when you generate those models, the way you generate those models can be optimized to run on a specific type of silicon. You don't need, you can run it on general purpose, but you can get it, you know, run for a fraction of the cost at a fraction of the power and so forth. And we kind of need that because the way AI is going at the moment, there's not enough power in the world to sort of generate all the models that people need. I think there's also some of the glosses coming off AI. People are realizing, you know, it's definitely new and it can be added to everything, but it's not the, there are challenges with it. And we've gone through the shiny phase and now we're getting into the... not quite as awesome as I thought, but it's still pretty good though. You know, it's like that new car feeling. You get your car, you're all excited. 2 weeks in, it's starting to feel a bit comfortable, but it's still good because it's a new car. That's kind of where I feel like we are.
Yeah, I feel like there's floods of money going into the space. Obviously, NVIDIA minting money with its approach. So competitors are going to try to copy that approach. And lots of executives are thinking, oh, with all this AI stuff, I can get rid of staff. So I want to do that. So I'm willing to invest in AI so I can get rid of my workers. So yes, I think the intensity of the hype is only going to increase regardless. But yes, there are also significant issues like hallucinations, like the power demands that these AI systems demand.
I'm comfortable with that because at the end of the day, if AI is making mistakes, then humans are as well. That's okay.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So they don't have to, if they're only running at human level, then that's fine because replacing humans with AI may be cheaper or in general way, if they're making less mistakes than humans, it's a bit like self-driving cars. What we know so far is that self-driving cars results in less deaths than driving cars. But when they make a mistake, it tends to be fairly apocalyptic. It tends to be like a big deal. So you have a PR problem more than you actually have a technology failure. But so let's leave that aside for the moment. If AI can make less mistakes than humans, the problem is that it's going to take a while for people to get used to the fact that, oh, yeah, if the AI made a mistake, it's probably less than a human would in the equivalent situation, right?
It depends on the kind of mistake and the scale of a mistake or the impact of those mistakes that have people worried.
But what I think is key, I mean, a couple of weeks back, I made fun of Sam Altman, you know, and OpenAI, and they were running around saying, we need $7 trillion in funding to build our own AI hardware or some, I think, you know, that guy's ego and ability to make himself at the center of every story is quite amazing. And for people to blindly just sit there and, you know, suck up a story of somebody who wants to brag about idiot stuff. He's another Elon Musk sort of thing, you know, that he does successfully do things, but then pretty soon after he manages to offside everybody that's involved with it. Like Sam Altman is not clearly not a nice person to work with because even his colleagues at OpenAI are saying, we don't like him very much, but he's Sam Altman sort of thing, right?
Right.
Which is, and that's an indictment. But, you know, if you're asking $7 trillion to build your own hardware, it doesn't cost $7 trillion to build a fab. It costs TSMC in Arizona. It is estimated to cost about $40 billion for the first two phases, mm-hmm. or the first two stages, over, you know, a 5 to 10 year period. That's not $7 trillion, right? And we're talking about other people here building chips. Talos, which comes out of Canada, needs $50 million in funding to get to the first stage. And it'll get the chip built at TSMC or at Intel or whatever, right? Or Samsung or whatever fab they decide to pick up on. You don't need $7 trillion, which makes Sam Altman a bit of a joke in my mind, because he's clearly putting himself in the center of the story to get as much focus so his ego can go out and so he can go out and be that figure that he thinks he is, right?
Well, we know that the tech industry lives on hype and lives on big pronouncements and big dreams, and that the media will gladly eat up those stories and excrete them back out. So it's a tried and true strategy, and just the numbers get bigger and the bloviation gets bigger.
Not so much here, though. Not so much here.
Well, we try to be the anti excreter, I'll say.
we bring a little dubiousness, as I call it. A little bit of dubiousness, I think. Yeah.
So we'll move on. In other AI news, Microsoft has announced that it's going to make AI models from Mistral. This is an OpenAI competitor available on its Azure cloud platform. Reuters also reports that Microsoft is taking a minority stake in Mistral. Well, I don't think Microsoft has confirmed that. As you know, Microsoft is a significant investor in OpenAI. So this reads to me like some hedging of the bets.
So, you know, obviously Microsoft has reportedly invested over $10 billion into OpenAI. OpenAI is technically a nonprofit that's working for the benefit of society, except for it's got a for-profit arm, you know, and so on and so on. It's a massively troubled company, you know, or as I've alluded to in the previous article, founders had a massive falling out, a very public disintegration before some adults intervened to tell them to settle down and get on with the work. Well, it turns out now that OpenAI has got Elon Musk as an early but now silent investor. He's now suing them for things. You can go and look that up if you want to understand it. And, you know, basically what's happening here is that rich people often sue people for fun, partly because they have the money and partly because ego is the most important thing. But in this case, Elon Musk set up another AI company. And so now he wants to make sure that the focus is on him and his new company. So if he can sue OpenAI and generate some media coverage, that's good value for money. And we're also seeing many, many questions being asked about whether OpenAI has ethically sourced the data used to train its model. All the data, all the evidence points to, at this point, just mass theft of copyrighted material on the internet. So they just went out and stole the internet, basically, even if it was copyrighted material. And they refused to open themselves up and say, you know, yes, we stole your material, to prove one way or the other. Did they not steal it or did they? And they just sort of sit there and say, well, we have to have it. We wouldn't be in business if we didn't get all this data. And if we couldn't use it, we couldn't be in business. And people are saying, well, if you're going to use my data to make a profit, you owe me money, right? So, yeah, we'll
so
see
maybe
what
he
happens.
Needs that $7 trillion to pay all the licensing fees that are going to come open the eyes way eventually.
Well, you know, if you've sucked up every single textbook you can find on the internet, you owe people copyright money.
Right? Yeah, every novel, every film. Yeah, exactly.
So what I really see here is that this is Microsoft saying AI is critical to the future of their business. OpenAI has already proved that. Obviously, OpenAI is now integrated in Bing and various things, and they've got a product that they sell via Azure, which is the OpenAI in the back end. But having a diverse supplier for AI software is probably important, because if OpenAI is an untrustable element, which it certainly is, you know, so for example, as I was saying before, there's a company called Inflection AI. They've just announced that its chatbot is at least as good as OpenAI's latest version, 3.5, I think, or 4.5, mm-hmm. whatever. But it only used 40% of the compute and training resources to get to the same thing. So, and I think also the key here is reducing power consumption of AI is an issue. So if I'm Microsoft, I'm looking around and going, OpenAI, that's just not a stable partner. I need to have others. And I think you're going to see a lot more of this. I think Google's going to bet on its own internal, but I think it's going to go third party just in case its internal fails. The days of getting your internal right is gone. Google's proven that it's not the company that it once was. And I think AWS is also betting on its internal, but at some point they're going to go external. I think these companies don't seem to be able to produce an AI model themselves, or we would have seen it by now, right? So getting a multi-supplier, I think, is what's the core here with Microsoft.
Yeah, I also feel like the industry is starting to digest AI, particularly around generative AI, like some models are good at some things, less good at other things. Some models are more efficient to run versus other models. And so the business aspect is now coming into coming into play here, as opposed to just the initial, like, wow, look at this chatbot that's so awesome, that gloss is coming off and people are starting to make more rational decisions about what is actually the best tool for the job. And obviously Microsoft wants to spread its bets across as many platforms as possible. So yeah, bringing on other AI into its cloud makes perfect sense.
Keep in mind that Microsoft's spending $10 billion a quarter on cloud build out, right? That's its hardware spend. So spending $1 billion on an AI piece of another, sure. Yeah. You know?
Yep. What's $1 billion among friends?
It's Microsoft, right? They're still making that sort of money from Microsoft Office, for goodness sake.
That's right. Yeah. All right, moving on. The Register is reporting that Amazon has purchased a data center campus that's powered by nuclear energy.
Yeah, not much to say about this, except for the fact that the only thing that makes this newsworthy is it's a nuclear power plant and there's a data center next door, literally on the piece of ground next door. And the energy company itself built the data center to use the to use carbon-free power. So the big deal here is, of course, it's carbon-free power. Now, I just want to point out that, yes, nuclear power plants are non-carbon generating, but they do have a climate or an environmental impact, because at the end of the life cycle and even during the life cycle, you have a lot of toxic waste that has to be done. So don't confuse carbon-free with environmental impact, right? Which is what everybody who talks about nuclear wants to sort of go, oh, but it's carbon-free. Yes, but it's not environmentally a sign thing to do.
It's not environmentally pure.
That's right.
Yes.
So really the story here is, oh, we put a data center next to a nuclear power plant, but that's not really the story that I want to focus on. I think the power plant generates about 2 gigawatts of electricity and the data center is going to get 960 megawatts. So basically 50% of that nuclear power plant is going to go into a data center that Amazon owns. And that's a 10-year supply agreement. So the key here is that mega clouds really don't want commitment, right? They don't want a long-term supply agreement. What they're always betting on is that, yes, they're operating long-term businesses and they may have to invest a lot of capital up front to build a data center, but they want short-term supply agreements because they're betting that the cost of technology over time will decrease, right? So computers get cheaper or they get more capability over time, or the cost of electricity will reduce over time, or that you can build a data center more efficiently over time, or your software can become more efficient over time, or you can build an AI chipset that's more efficient to generate AI. So they like to buy on very short-term cycles. They'll buy assets like servers, and originally they bet that they would only last 2 years and they'd always have to replace them. It turns out that they're now keeping those servers typically 6 years, because they're now able to make it more efficient and so forth. So the story here is that AWS signed up for a 10-year commitment, which is not normally something they do with power. Normally they sign up for 3 to 5 year, 5 year agreements is the maximum for electricity supply, because they don't like to negotiate long-term. They want to be able to say, oh, that data center is no good anymore. Just walk away, shut it down, walk away from it sort of thing. So it is quite a story here is that this is 10 years next to a power plant, which is also a signal that if you want to get a gigawatt of power, there's not a whole lot of places in America you can go and get a gigawatt of power through, right?
Right.
So locating it next to a power plant is probably about the best way possible. And it also reduces the risk around the transmission grid. One of the things that is a problem in most of Western countries is that their power grids are becoming increasingly old and have not been substantially invested in. And the one in America, apparently, from what I read, is particularly worrying. The power grid there is becoming increasingly fragile and needs a massive investment in it to upgrade it, according to what I read. So, you know, maybe AWS is saying, yeah, we don't really want to rely on the power grid. So maybe this is a step in that direction as well.
Yeah. And another way to look at this is there are lots of attempts to get new nuclear capacity built, but you run into issues of, in many cases, people saying, I'm uncomfortable with a nuclear power plant in my area, which is an entirely reasonable thing. But now energy companies can say, we've got good customers for this. We've got big data centers that want to come and move here to consume this power and also create jobs and stuff, which you can see having, you know, an ameliorative effect on, you know, some of the agencies that are responsible for, you know, permitting these plants and allowing them to go forward and stuff. It helps the power generating companies who want to build new plants tell a better story when you can say we've got potential huge customers who will come in here into the region as well to use this new power we want to put online.
I know we've talked about small modular reactors or SMR.
Yeah.
And this is this idea that you can build a small, you know, football field sized reactor that could be used to produce a modest amount of electricity, say,
right,
you know, 100 megawatts to 200 megawatts, say. And the only company that had a planning permission in to build that withdrew all of its planning requests this last month. Mm. So if you have any plans at all of expecting nuclear energy to be a thing, there's no evidence
it's a hard market.
Yeah. That, you know, the problem with nuclear is it takes 5 to 10 years to go through, at least 5 years, typically 20 years to go through the planning approval. The construction will take another 5 to 20 years as well. Same like right. Here in the UK, they've been faffing around on building nuclear reactors for 20 years and they're still, you know, not still 10 years away from getting them working. And you know, the climate problem needs to be solved before then. We can't wait 30 years for nuclear power to come online. So yeah. My sense is if you think that nuclear is going to solve it for you, it could be part of the mix, but it's 25 years away, even if you could fund it today, which is unlikely. And companies that are trying to fund it and get them built are facing an uphill battle. And so I think it's you know, whatever you've got, if you've got a nuclear power plant, that's fine. Keep it running, extend the life. Generate that low carbon. But
you know. Now that I'm thinking about it, that may be also another angle here, because the power plant we're talking about here is in Susquehanna, Pennsylvania. It's been around for decades already. So, and these older power plants sometimes get more scrutiny because of their age. And so having a new customer come in, like a giant data center complex, is also a way for them to say, look, we're still relevant. And now we're getting new money that we can invest in safety and upgrades and so on to keep this old power plant up and running. So
they'll have a guaranteed supply contract. They'll know how much money they work and there'll be a megawatt hour and all that sort of stuff. It could be good for them to be able to say, we need to build another one here. And
potentially,
you couldn't quite often get planning for removal to put another one next to the existing ones because.
Right. Or just keep this because there's often movements in communities to get old power plants shut down. I think that's happening in Massachusetts around a reactor.
Well, the one I'm thinking of is Germany, who particularly shut down all of their nuclear and then continued to do so even when it was a bad idea. And now they have an energy crisis after Ukraine invaded Russia because they can't get the gas.
Yeah.
They went over to a natural gas economy to fulfill their industrial base.
Very bad timing.
And they should have kept their nuclear reactors running instead. Yeah.
Yeah.
The ones that were there, not build new ones, just keep them going.
Yeah. All right, links in the show notes as always. A quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Itential. Itential is a network automation platform. It lets you build robust self-service automation. Maybe you've written some Python scripts or an Ansible playbook, but who besides you can safely use those scripts or run those playbooks? If you answered nobody, that's not good. Itential lets anyone on your team run scripts safely as a workflow that integrates with your change management systems, ticketing systems, IPAM, monitoring, and anything else you need. It integrates with every system that needs updating and testing when you need a network change. Itential is low code, so you don't need to be a software developer to use it. So whether you're just getting started with network automation or you're deep down the rabbit hole, Itential can help. Automate from ticket creation to ticket closure. Find out more at itential.com/packetpushers. That's itential.com/packetpushers. All right, a few more stories before we wrap. Dell and Broadcom have issued a joint announcement to reassure customers of VxRail and VMware Cloud Foundation on VxRail that both companies are committed to ongoing delivery and support for customers.
There's not a whole lot here, Drew, if you read it. It's just basically reassuring customers that VxRail and VMware Cloud Foundation are ongoing. The obvious thing here is, they shouldn't have had to release this notice to say, because the obvious thing is that customers must not be happy about where things are going, right? It's a clear signal that VMware by Broadcom is struggling with its messaging to customers, because a public statement like this should just not be needed.
Right. And
we've talked a lot about how VMware is really struggling to reach customers where they are. And they've generated a lot of confusion since Broadcom took over. So Dell having to publicly communicate such a message would suggest that sales are being impacted, because Dell is the ultimate coin operated organization. It's a sales driven business. If there's any impact to sales, Dell is going to do something about it. So that's my reading on it. What do you think? Do you agree?
Oh, totally. You know, when you read it feels like two marketing and PR teams from the different companies sat down and wrote this, and each one had to sort of get their digs in, their licks in, which makes it really hard to parse as to what's actually going on. And the second thing is, if I were a VxRail customer and I read this announcement, I would find it actually less reassuring than what it's intended to do, because it reads to me like two divorced parents who are sitting down with the kids to ask which parent they want to go live with.
Yeah, well, as we've talked about, two, three months ago now, Dell did have a preferential supply agreement with VMware. Mm-hmm. So when they sold VMware hyperconverged bundles or sold VMware, they had a 3% pricing advantage because Dell was a preferred supplier obviously Dell used to own VMware,
right.
Indirectly, not directly, you know, and spun in, spun out, who knows, whatever, right? But this is the, also, let me just talk about, do you notice it's VMware by Broadcom? This is something I only picked up recently. The new name for VMware. VMware by Broadcom. It's no longer VMware. Every press release says VMware by Broadcom. So there's a, it's a bit like Palo Alto Networks. You have to say, you can't just say Palo or Palo Alto. You have to say Palo Alto Networks, right? You have to say the full name when you're talking a bit in marketing speak.
Yes.
And there's lots of those, Juniper Networks. You can't just call it Juniper because Juniper is somebody else. You have to say Juniper Networks is the official marketing name. So for them to go with VMware by Broadcom, they only do this when they want to send a signal, right? And if you're in the trenches, you just might not notice that there's signal being sent up because it's fairly subtle. It's a signal that Broadcom does not want you to see the old VMware. They're not trying to do an invisible transition to customers. They're saying VMware is now owned by Broadcom and everything's going to change. Right. That's kind of a signal coming out here. Do you agree with that?
I mean, that's definitely what's happening. So whether it was an intentional signal or not, that's clearly the message. And to me, it feels like, you know, VMware has a strong brand loyalty, but Broadcom also wants to be known as VMware's owner. So it just feels more like ego to me than anything else. But I take your point.
Well, I think Broadcom learned a lesson from watching Intel put its CPUs inside laptops. Remember, every laptop always came with an Intel inside sticker on it?
Yep. Yep.
Like as if you care. Why would you care, right, that there's an Intel CPU inside your laptop? It's a laptop. It's a Dell laptop. So the idea of putting an Intel inside sticker on the outside is a way to get your product in front of customers so that they value the contribution you made. Now, you know, to be a bit like your cornflakes in the morning, if you were using a brand of corn, like shiny red corn, you know, some... I'm not very good at brand naming, but you know, if your Kellogg's cornflakes came said using such and such a brand, you know, from such and such a farm corn, that would be just like, so what, right? And that's kind of what's going on here. So I think what's happening here is that Broadcom is trying to say, you need to know about us. We want our brand outside.
Yes.
So when we talk about switches, we talk about the Broadcom ASIC. Broadcom's gone to a lot of effort to make customers aware of networking switches that have Broadcom ASICs inside. People talk a lot about Broadcom's Ethernet adapters a lot and so forth and so on. So I think Broadcom wants to make sure that their brand is strong and they want customers to know about them, even though they only provide components, they don't provide entire solutions, right? VMware is not a solution in its own right. You still have to put applications and software on top of it. So it's very easy for Broadcom to get lost in all of that thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, because they don't call it Symantec by Broadcom. They don't call it CA by Broadcom, do they? It's just, I think that the strength of the VMware brand Broadcom wants to make sure it's attached to.
Maybe. I don't think so. I think that when they talk about Symantec, they talk about Symantec from Broadcom or Broadcom. Yes. All the Symantec branding is Symantec by Broadcom. You have the Symantec logo and then underneath it, it says by Broadcom. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, so it's par for the course.
Yeah. It's par for the course. They want to make sure the Broadcom brand is attached to everything. Yeah.
Definitely.
So yeah, it's the universal thing.
All right, moving on. Last week, we had talked about issues with undersea cables in the Red Sea. There was speculation that Houthis were targeting cables directly, but now it seems more likely that cable damage was a second-order effect from a Houthi attack on a cargo ship. The ship was abandoned after the Houthis attacked it, and it was dragging its anchor, which was most likely the cause of damage instead of direct attacks on undersea cabling. And Greg, you wanted to weigh in before we wrap up this story.
Well, I wasn't here last week.
Yes, you got to get your oar in.
But I know that you and Jonah did discuss this. It's not exactly clear. There are some reports actually say the ship was abandoned and the captain left the anchor out and the anchor then dragged across the cables and snapped it. There was other people who said they actually took control of the ship, forced them to throw the anchor out and to drag it across the ocean floor or the canal, you know,
the Red Sea channel
until, and in the hope that a cable would be broken. And indeed some cables were broken. But I think I wanted to extend this a little bit and point out that there are also undersea gas pipelines and undersea electricity cables as well. And they are equally vulnerable to the same attacks. So one of the things about these undersea cables is nobody really cares. Everybody's sort of going, huh, we got plenty of redundancy. We got plenty of resiliency. We'll get a ship out there and eventually be repaired. I think there's a second factor here, which is a little bit not so pleasant, which is it's a part of the world that not too many people care about, right? You're sort of talking about the cables go around the bottom of Yemen and up into some states and then across to India and places like that. It's not a part of the world that's a real high value market, if that makes sense.
For Western-centric people, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, this compared to everything else that's happening, you know, hard to get panicked about everything in the world that's going on at the moment. So
Right.
maybe we're not seeing it. But I do think there's definitely a sense of panic around, hang on, if we can start to see uncrewed underwater vessels, so basically drones, underwater drones, and they can go down and attack these cables, because there was some speculation that the Houthis were actually using drones to blow up these cables, which I find unlikely because finding those cables is not easy.
Right.
But I think what we're seeing is there's a sort of a panic setting in that undersea gas and electric conduits could be attacked. And with military analysts sort of saying, you know, uncrewed drones could be doing this, that's a problem because gas and electricity loses votes. You know,
sure.
If you can't warm your houses or run your factories, there's a bigger problem. So I think this is going to be a bigger issue. Under the, you know, undersea cabling for internet is probably going to get the benefit of that. But I don't think that the undersea cables, you know, internet access is a key issue for the world yet.
All right, links in the show notes. We'll move on. Broadcom has announced new PCIe Gen 5 and Gen 6 Express retimers that, quote, extend reach, lower power dissipation, simplified interop and end-to-end management. Broadcom is positioning these new retimers as well-suited for servers and other infrastructure connected to an AI fabric because they consume less power but offer maximum reach.
That's not very exciting, this press release, Drew. Probably
it's
one
really
of the dullest.
I was like, why are we talking about retimers? How deep into the guts of a machine do we have to go for news?
So what people forget is that PCIe or PCI Express is a network in its own right. Usually it's a short network on across a motherboard, right? It connects various devices and it's a short and it's a bus, right? And it's in the same way that Ethernet is a serial layer 2, synchronous, unreliable, unstable, unpredictable, and low-speed networking technology. PCI Express is a parallel, high-speed, reliable, low-latency network. It just doesn't have the distance because of the way it works. It's very high bandwidth and high speed. And that's the premise behind CXL. So CXL and PCIe sort of go hand in hand. And what we have at the moment is that for AI processing, we need to use massive amounts of data moving around. And at the moment, they're using InfiniBand. But InfiniBand sort of tops out at around, you know, 512 ports, maybe scales up to 1,000, 2,000 ports with a really committed effort, you know, from various people. But what would be even better is if you could just connect the PCI buses inside of all the servers together. And that is exactly what's happening here. These are retimers so that you can extend the PCI bus between a cluster of servers and not need AI Ethernet. And there's an awful lot of noise and smoke and not much action coming out around AI Ethernet. So that's what it means, right? It's not obvious. It took me a while to tweak to it. What happens if PCIe and CXL suddenly starts to replace AI Ethernet? Is that a thing?
I do not feel qualified to put in an opinion here. I will say that.
I think the mega clouds absolutely want AI Ethernet. They're not happy with putting fiber channel in their data centers or InfiniBand in their data centers or PCIe, you know, as a networking technology. But enterprises are absolutely happy to run multiple networks inside of their data centers. They'll run Ethernet, they'll run InfiniBand, they'll run sort of fiber channel for storage and all that sort of stuff. They got no problems with that. And if you could imagine a PCIe Express networking technology that expends, say, 3 to 5 racks in a row and gives you, you know, really, really high speed, but without all of that nasty cruft that you have to add to Ethernet to try and turn it into an expansion, well, then that might be enough, right? And I think actually it'll probably be substantially cheaper than any sort of Ethernet. And it'll certainly be more reliable and predictable than any Ethernet, because Ethernet is just so poor. It's serial, it's asynchronous, so you can't guarantee how long it'll take. It can drop. So even if you slap on all of this AI Ethernet features you need to make it look like InfiniBand or look like, you know, a synchronous network, it's still never going to be stable and reliable for another decade, given that networking vendors take 10 years to make this sort of stuff stable. And by then, a PCI network might be well established. So there.
That's very interesting. And maybe this is Broadcom hedging their bets because they also do want to sell you custom ASICs that are, they say, are optimized to build AI Ethernet fabrics. Mm. But if you don't go that route, then maybe they also have this PCIe mechanism. Although, yeah, I guess I'm not sure that you could build very large clusters of GPUs only using this method.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Well, NVIDIA has a thing called NVLink, which is fundamentally a server bus. And that's the way that they interconnect their GPUs inside a server. Mm-hmm. And they can actually connect, I think, up to 32 GPUs via NVLink before they have to break out of the box or something like that. Right.
Okay.
So if you could replace the concept of NVLink and NVIDIA with a PCI Express running, you know, Gen 6, which is really high speed, then maybe you just don't need Ethernet networking for AI. You just use your Ethernet to go out to the other stuff.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I think maybe we should put that on the prediction list.
Yeah, it's a good one.
That is a good one, yeah.
That's what retimers means. It means the signal coming off the internal bus can be retimed to go externally or between servers. That's what they're talking about, yeah.
All right, our last story for the day. Cisco has announced new executive leadership roles in customer experience officer, operations, and a chief strategy officer. Now, Greg, I feel like we're getting into a bit of criminology here to see what kind of information we can glean from these moves.
Yeah, I don't normally cover this type of moves because executives are interchangeable, easily replaced, and they don't make much of a difference. That's, you know, they can make small changes and maybe they get like two or three times a year they can actually make a decision that actually changes the direction of something. And in general, good executives don't matter because when they do their job, they just do their job. But bad executives definitely do have an outsized impact, just for clarity there, right? So you expect executives to do their job and generally be invisible, and they're easily replaced by somebody else. But my thesis here is that Chuck Robbins knows that investors are less than pleased with the growth that Cisco's got, which is basically flat over a decade. And right now, the revenue is falling, the profits are falling. Cisco's future is, and it, you know, but they pay a dividend, and you know, investors are happy. So it's not like the end of the world. Cisco's a pretty stable, boring business, follows the market. But, you know, the shuffling executives is a big sign that something is actually happening. And it's particularly appealing to shareholders, investors, particularly because in the case of Cisco's case, Cisco executives have a hugely outsized pay relative to its cohorts in other companies. So one of the things that you don't see at the senior executive levels in Cisco is they don't leave because they're literally worth so much money that their pay packets are outsized. And every now and then an investor comes along and says, when are we going to sort out the oversized pay packets of executives? Why is that money not going to shareholders? Why is it going to executives? And for some reason, that grumbling never seems to get legs. Anyway, active investors have been rumored to be looking at the company and considering whether to shake it up. We've spoken about this a couple of times because there are some people who think that, you know, if you could do things to Cisco, you could shake it up and turn it into something that's revitalized because it's a pretty boring and stayed stock, and there's no path to growth because they've got a portfolio of a stable middle of the road products and tech. They follow the market in the same way that Arista does. You know, once a product is established and there's definitely a market for it and we know what the customers want, then Cisco will buy someone to deliver that, right? The Splunk acquisition has made this much harder now. They've just blown $28 billion in cash and debt to buy that. So now the balance sheet doesn't look quite as attractive for a takeover. And I think analysts don't view this acquisition as hugely growth. It certainly buys some extra revenue. It'll shift the revenue up by whatever Splunk makes per quarter. But it's not like it's going to generate huge cost savings or accelerate sales of other things. It's going to be just another business unit. And effectively, they're buying revenue for growth. So. Yeah. If you're shuffling this around, I take this as saying to shareholders and analysts, oh, look, we're doing something. We're changing the exec. We're refreshing our executive team. Please don't look at our bad results and that things aren't going well and our numbers are falling and customers are still digesting the products that they bought 2 years ago and we're struggling. You know, I think that's what we're seeing here is a bit of a deck chairs sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that the same stock phrases that they apply to their products, like accelerate innovation and simplicity, are also being applied to people in this case. And it does have all of the Wall Street compliant buzzwords, AI, long-term growth, you find that in there, which this to me is a signal that, yeah, we know we have a problem. We're trying to do something about it. Some fresh new faces that are going to help us innovate our way out of this stagnation.
Not going to lie, Cisco press releases are hard work. They are, because they bloviate extensively. I do wonder if they've been writing them with AI and they've ramped up the prompt to be more bombastic, more bloviation, more big words. It is a little difficult to read them, but anyway, you can go and read this post and you can make your own thoughts on this.
Absolutely. As always, the link will be in the show notes. That does wrap up the news portion of the show. Thanks for being with us. Please do stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with Cisco Thousand Eyes. Speaking of Cisco, we're going to be talking about how network performance information is being extended across the Cisco portfolio. That's coming right up. Today on the Tech Bytes podcast, we drill into new capabilities from the Cisco ThousandEyes team, including enhancements to endpoint monitoring to help IT more quickly identify performance issues by application, and integrations with ThousandEyes and Cisco Secure Access to provide a correlated view for network and security teams to spot problem areas and identify fixes. Cisco ThousandEyes is our sponsor, and my guest is Marco Tisler, Group Product Manager for EMEA. Marco, welcome to the podcast. So Cisco made multiple announcements at Cisco Live EMEA in February recently. Let's start with what ThousandEyes is doing with Cisco Secure Access, and Cisco Secure Access is Cisco's SSE offering Secure Services Edge.
The first one I kind of like to mention is the integration that you mentioned with Cisco Secure Access. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing there is our digital experience monitoring solution called Endpoint Agent is now embedded with Cisco Secure Access. So the client part of it that goes on users' devices and laptops. And it really becomes part of the same client bundle. So it's a module within it. Mm-hmm. And with that, we've answered or addressed the question of why another agent, or more the objection of not another agent, because every time IT departments deploy more and more pieces of software, obviously, there are concerns with regards to resources, managing another piece of software. And by combining the Cisco Secure client and the endpoint agent from ThousandEyes, we make this much more streamlined and we make those concerns go away. But more importantly, we're also now able to provide the data on the Cisco Secure Access dashboard that's consumed by SecOps and or NetOps engineers to troubleshoot the digital experience or connectivity of corporate assets and workstations, laptops to the applications they need to use. And it provides us what we call common operational language between these multiple teams and one single dashboard that they can use to troubleshoot these issues either together or quickly hand off between the different departments.
All right, so let me read that back to you. So there's a Cisco Secure client, and that is, I presume, what helps direct traffic into the cloud security services. And now you've integrated the ThousandEyes endpoint agent with that client as well. So you're not just getting the security elements, you're also getting digital experience monitoring right at the desktop in one client piece of software.
Yeah, that is correct. And one of the drivers behind it is that one of the drivers for measuring digital experience within cloud-delivered security environments is that cloud-delivered security improves the agility and resilience and also mm-hmm. performance, especially in today's, I'm going to say, distributed world where your infrastructure is distributed, your applications are distributed, but also your workforce is distributed. Yeah. So it kind of became the necessity. But all of this also increases the reliance on the distributed network or networks themselves that sit between either your enterprise perimeter, and the enterprise perimeter could be your branch office, your headquarters, and in some cases, it might be your mobile workforce or people working from home. And it makes it difficult for IT departments as well as security teams to isolate problems that are affecting users in this when they're accessing applications in this sort of environment. And this is really why you need a digital experience monitoring solution to help with that effort, so to help navigate this complexity and help pinpoint to where things are breaking quicker.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting because I was thinking to myself, I understand why the network engineering team would want to be able to monitor performance for end users, but for the security team, I don't know why they would care. But now I'm getting the sense that, particularly when you're talking about cloud-delivered security, in some ways, this is a tool for them to say, you know, when a problem is raised, they can... The first thing they can say is, you know, meantime innocence, it's not us. It's not the security services that are causing a performance problem because we have the metrics right in front of us.
Exactly. So in some way, that goes back to the statement I made about, you know, putting another agent on the device. Because that agent, the question that some of the more technically astute folks might have, you know, how is this going to affect my actual device, my resources, my performance? How is this going to affect the applications themselves? And the same question is when you adopt cloud-delivered security, you essentially put something in the path of communication. So the obvious conclusion is, or the obvious question is going to be, how does this affect my communication and the services that I need to access? And it's really important to be able to provide and reassure the user or the users that this additional component doesn't introduce additional latency loss, jitter that is detrimental to accessing the applications that users require.
Right. And you also mentioned sort of a common language for different parts of the IT department to speak. So I'm guessing it's not Cisco saying security is now in charge of monitoring performance, but it's on their dashboard. If it comes up and they need to collaborate with other parts of the IT group and that comes up, they all are working from the same information.
Exactly. So I think when it comes to networking and security, everybody understands loss, latency, jitter. We have a common understanding of the network path. So where does the path need to traverse? And we have a common understanding when things break, as long as we can determine without any doubt where that breaking point is. So having the visibility of, does the communication break between the client and, for example, Cisco Secure Access headend, so someone on the path, either because of your last mile provider, something going on your laptop, or something else, versus when it exits the Cisco Secure Access cloud towards your private application or a SaaS application, and maybe there's a breakage on that other leg. But I think the teams today will have a common understanding is if you can pinpoint to where the breaking point is, there will be no argument or no further meetings or discussions around, okay, who needs to own this or who needs to work with this further? Because that really is what we're trying to address, reduce the amount of time, or ideally eliminate the amount of time we have this war room type of settings where people from multiple departments or maybe even multiple vendors and stakeholders are come into a meeting trying to determine how to solve a problem. And the first step is going to be, what is the root cause that is causing the problem? And then who owns it? Who's responsible for solving the problem related to either that node or a network or point of presence of a service provider? So removing that noise and removing those conversations is a big time saver.
Yeah, I think, Marco, you may have a new metric here, reduce times in meetings, RTIM.
I will steal that, actually. I will steal that.
Yeah, and for folks who may not be familiar with, you know, the digital experience monitoring capabilities of the endpoint, you can get down into actual device performance, you know, memory and CPU. So you can measure the performance between the laptop and a Wi-Fi access point or a Wi-Fi router. You can measure the performance between that router and, you know, the first hop in the network all the way to the application. So you are getting really granular visible performance, which again, if you're trying to figure out where the problem domain is, this information would be very useful for a security team, especially to say, we know it's not us.
Correct. And I think one of the most common probably examples we see today is that we see two types of support cases really coming in. People complain about a application, usually it's some sort of a collaboration tool, or they complain about connectivity in general. And when they complain about a particular application, oftentimes it might be the lack of resources on the end device itself that are causing the issue. So even before we even enter any other network elements of the network path, the problem is caused by lack of resources on the device, CPU, memory. So what we've brought into the endpoint agent, and as a result also into the Cisco Secure Access dashboard, is the CPU and memory metrics as they relate to individual processes on the device. So the operator can quickly correlate the performance metrics of, say, on a given application and the resources on the laptop, but then also the what we call local network metrics, like some of the Wi-Fi metrics, signal quality, retransmissions, throughput, negotiated speeds, and so on, to determine, like, is the root cause somewhere very close to the client or on the client itself. And that you further reduce the amount of time spent in trying to figure out where to escalate or how to solve.
So there's other announcements you made, including this is related to the ThousandEyes endpoint in particular. You've got more system process metrics that you can use to pinpoint per application performance.
Correct. So, and this is only the first step. We're beginning with, so obviously we also have things like we know the operating system of the device, the model of the device, which are sometimes actually some of the data points used to correlate issues across a wider client population. Because what might happen in some case is maybe you're focusing on processes, CPU, memory, and so on. But in some other cases, maybe the common denominator between all the clients that are failing is they're running the same operating system. And because of some sort of compatibility issues, driver upgrades, and so forth, the difference between clients that are having a good experience and the clients that are having a bad experience is just that the operating system, the Wi-Fi driver, and so on. So we use, and we will continue to enrich some of those data points to make it easier to determine what those common denominators are, whether on client or on the infrastructure.
And you're also able to tie it to individual applications, is that correct?
That's correct. ThousandEyes, we've always kind of focused on the application first, and the North Star metric is the quality of experience towards the application. So there's different ways you can view this data. The application or groups of applications, the networks used to access said applications, the device types used when accessing those applications. So it's a really rich data set, which you can explore from multiple angles. So one angle is an individual device. And for that individual device, you only care maybe about a handful of applications and how individual metrics relate to those. But then maybe if you're more focused on IT operations, top-down use cases, like how does my client population operate in general? Am I hitting my 99.99% reliability, for example? You can look at that, you know, across and then find these common factors between the devices that are not operating up to standard, and also have a general idea of, you know, how well or bad things are across the whole population.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned earlier sort of being able to get down into like, this could be a driver issue affecting lots of people. If you were having lots of support tickets come in saying the network is slow, you know, your first thought might be, okay, this maybe is a backbone issue or some broader network issue, not it's an issue on the client with a specific driver that's affected. And we can now prove this and be proactive because, you know, we can let other folks know who are also running this operation system, hey, there's this issue, maybe you want to update this driver before it becomes a problem for them as well.
Correct. And that's, you know, from that top-down perspective, if, you know, maybe you had one client support reporting an issue or reporting a case. And because you have this top-down view or cross-population view, you can then quickly jump on it and let others know before those become service affecting or before those users are starting to complain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that being useful if, you know, you figure it out on the East Coast and you can let folks know before the West Coast wakes up and starts hitting those service tickets.
Yeah, thank you. You have to take advantage of the time zone difference. You have to.
Okay, Marco, anything else on this, on the system process metrics in the ThousandEyes endpoints before we move on?
I just kind of like to say that the digital experience monitoring as part of cloud delivered security is something that ensures end users have a seamless and performant digital experience. And the name of the product within Cisco Secure Access, by the way, is Experience Insights. Mm-hmm. And it solves what we think is the critical problem by allowing our customers to continuously monitor the health of their endpoints, their company-owned assets, connections, and applications.
There's other announcements that came out. One that jumped out at me that I thought was interesting is ThousandEyes doing enhanced API monitoring. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the notion of API monitoring is obviously nothing new, and ThousandEyes is well-positioned to execute there as well. And one of our common types of customer are the site reliability teams. And with these teams, they really are interested in the uptime and how various APIs or API targets affect the digital experience of the actual users using the application. So to provide a deeper visibility into how the API layer affects digital experience, we've developed a API monitoring solution. And the way it differs from the what I would say regular or legacy ThousandEyes tests is that in this particular case, you have different types of interactions, like you send a GET request, POST request, DELETE request, and then you can build those interactions in a chain. So you would monitor how an application accesses those APIs in order to maybe render a front end or retrieve the data necessary for the user to achieve their tasks in the application. Mm-hmm. And by modeling those common flows of API calls, you can then assure that everything is working correctly, or if there is a breaking point, because there might be multiple API calls in a chain for a particular part of interaction. So you can ensure that if something does break, you know where it's breaking, you can quickly go and fix it.
Yeah, so much of the modern applications now are driven by APIs that getting visibility into this is could be essential if you're trying to diagnose problems.
Yeah, and sometimes the problems are not as simple as things are working versus not working. Sometimes the problems are more contextualized in terms of things are suddenly slower. And maybe there's a particular API call that started responding slower. Maybe there's a particular API that becomes sluggish because on the back end, the database access is becoming slow. So it's no longer that black and white, you know, API is working, not working, but also, is it working slower than usual? Is something different than usual? And just having that baseline information available is very helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that baseline and that context can make resolution a lot easier, I'm assuming.
That's correct. And with that, we're also providing task recommendations. So one of the things and one of the capabilities we introduced is the AWS task recommendations with API Gateway. So to be able to quickly discover, deploy tests in cloud-hosted APIs, so in AWS environments.
And speaking of testing, I understand one of the other announcements is that you've now got more test templates to help people set up these tests more easily.
Correct. Yeah. So besides the templates that we've done for AWS API Gateway that enables users to quickly discover and deploy tests so they can start monitoring their critical cloud-hosted APIs, we've done something very similar for the Endpoint Agent where you can select your application of choice, and we're offering some of the most popular application as templates. And you no longer have to decide, you know, what is going to be the destination for my test and how do I construct the test itself. It's already constructed by means of templates. And all you have to do is push that template down to the endpoint agents and you start monitoring the digital experience of that application. So we're streamlining the test deployment process itself. So you don't have to spend a lot of time figuring out, you know, how does my test need to look like and how does my construction of a test need to be in order for me to achieve the outcome that I want. Because at the end of the day, I want to monitor a particular application and I want to know how it behaves. Everything else is our details.
Right. And if you can set that up for me, then I'm much closer to my goal of getting the information I need.
Yeah. We're talking about getting to the information that people need. The final thing I'd like to kind of mention is we did the enhancements of our dashboards that now supports filters and easier drill down. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to get from that, you know, again, from that high level view to a very specific data point of by means of using filters and by means of drilling down. And the reason why that's important is because on our dashboards, we do allow a mix of different data sets from different types of agents and tests. So we can explore the data set that in a large enterprise environment can become pretty complex.
Right.
You can explore that pretty quickly and go from, okay, something needs my attention to what it actually is or what the root cause is very, very quickly.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you're dealing with particularly endpoint monitoring, you're going to have a lot of those and all of the metrics that you're gathering, being able to filter on the most relevant information is going to help you get to that information faster.
Yeah, correct. I think especially the endpoint environment, because the way people move around and just the way they're exposed to different networks with different conditions throughout the day, it's really, really important that we're able to cut through this noise and make sure we don't show any red herrings or send people down the wrong path.
Right. So if folks want to find out more about ThousandEyes and the new features and capabilities and integrations, where should they go?
I would like to invite them to read our ThousandEyes blog. We recently published a blog on the innovation that we've presented at Cisco Live India. Mm-hmm. And there's a blog called Deeper Visibility for Remote Workforce Management, alongside with new system process metrics, API monitoring capabilities, and a streamlined setup for ThousandEyes endpoint agent tests.
All right. Yeah, we'll have those links in the show notes. And you can always just go to ThousandEyes.com/blog if you want to look for it yourself. But you can also find them in the show notes that accompany this podcast. Well, thank you, Marco, for joining us. And thanks to ThousandEyes for being a sponsor. And as always, thank you for being a listener. If you like this episode, you can find it and many more fine free technical podcasts and our community blog. It's all at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on LinkedIn, hear us on Spotify. And if you would, leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.